The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
This is middle income? Or
middle income. Yeah, great. Okay, well, I guess you might as well get started. My name is Michael Lorre. I am the president of the International Trade and Investment Law Society. We're happy to be here to have an Oxfam Hunger Banquet. It's actually my first time participating in it, but it seems like there's a good turnout. Things should go well. We've got two incredible speakers, hopefully some different perspectives. I have no doubt they have different views on some of the economic situations, but I think there will also be a lot of common ground. We really want to explore some of the policy issues. I'm sure we'll get into some of the legal issues as well. But we'll have a half hour at the end of this for any questions and reflections on the experience. Hopefully a lot of you will gain a lot from this experience. We also want to thank the Sustainable Development Law and Policy Publication that helped bring this event together, and the dining facility staff and the International Legal Studies Program. Really couldn't have done this without them. So the Oxfam Hunger Banquet is, as you can tell, we divide people up according to the population in the world and how income distribution is. To be honest, I think there's maybe a little too many people in the middle class here, but sometimes that's how it works with the lottery. But basically, this is how the world looks. You know, a lot of times you don't look around and see people from different classes. And when I'm talking about classes, I'm not necessarily talking about class in the United States. The high income at the table, for instance, is $10,000 a year or above. Now, in the U.S., that would be considered low class. So we're talking about some different issues than even here in the United States. But it should be noted that over 36 million Americans live in poverty. So this is an international issue, but it's also a domestic issue. I don't want to get into the policy issues too much, because I'm sure our speakers will cover them very well. But I just wanted to say that we're going to have about 10 minutes for everyone to be served food and eat your food in your respective position in the world for the next hour. And just reflect on it, talk to people around you, and then we'll get into the issues and allow people to have time for questions. And hopefully everyone will leave the room knowing a lot more about the issues and be able to tell other people. I hope you signed up for the list. We'll give you more information on any charities you might want to donate to. I know Oxfam is a great charity. There's also the local food bank, Capital Food Bank, which is really a great organization. But we'll deal with that afterwards. This is really about understanding the issues. And I don't really want people to look at this as like a charity issue. This is really just a human issue. Anyone starving, they really can't have any other human rights. If you have no food in your stomach, you can't learn, you can't participate in society. So this is really the core issue in human rights, I think. Not to say that other issues in human rights aren't important, but it's really tough to get to that point unless you have food in your stomach. So with that, I think we can serve the food, and we'll just let people soak in the experience for about 10 minutes, and then we'll get into the conversation. So thanks for coming.
Oh, I think that he's mixing some debate on policy as well. We got about 12 people.
What do I say?
We tested like too little ice cream to develop countries. And the other thing, they were generally angry, particularly angry. Like, we're hungry. We've been working all day for this. And you're eating chicken stuff. And
you told me when you're 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I hope everyone's not enjoying their lunch too much, but the one thing, unfortunately, that's a little unrealistic about this, I think there may be a little too much food, and maybe it's a little too good, but I think hopefully you'll get the point. And more importantly, though, we really need to get into these policy issues, and they're extremely important. And as most of you are law students, I think, you know, people who are eating, you know, the low class, low income, really probably low income, low class probably is the best way to put it, you know, they're not going to be able to, you know, fight for their own rights. So as law students, I think it's, you know, very important to understand these issues and to really be an advocate, you know, regardless of your political position. I don't think it's even, you know, as I said before, it's not a charity issue. You know, we're all humans, and really, it's in our own interest to not let people get to the point of desperation. And obviously, human dignity is the goal for human rights, and I think it's the goal for humanity in general. So with that, we'll let Mr. Kripke speak. He is a distinguished director of Oxfam America for the Policy and Research Section. I've had the privilege to hear him speak before. I think you will not be disappointed. And then following him from the Cato Institute and World Bank consultant is Mr. Ayar. And he is very well known. I stumbled upon an article he wrote, which just blew me away, so I had to contact him right away. And he was kind enough to agree to come, and we're very lucky to have him as well. But to start things off, I won't speak anymore.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks to all of you for coming and disrupting your lunch, probably eating, for most of you, less than you normally would, or maybe not as nice a lunch as you might normally do. Just to tell you a little bit about myself, I'm policy director here at Oxfam America, and I do what a policy director does, which is lobby and research and policy analysis. So I'm taking a very top-line view of these issues. I'm not on the ground providing food or doing development programs, but looking at the structural and legal issues that we think, Oxfam thinks, underlie the inequity that we're experiencing today. Just a word about Oxfam. Oxfam is an international development and humanitarian response agency. We our business model is to raise money in rich countries and spend it in poor countries. And Oxfam America doesn't take government funding, so we rely on the generosity of individuals and foundations. And we also don't take government money so that we can have a very strong political voice and don't feel obligated to or influenced by the government or by political influence. And we do humanitarian response when emergencies arise, like tsunamis and earthquakes. We go in with support and help. But for longer-term development, we rely on local partners. We don't actually do projects ourselves. We form partnerships with indigenous organizations and support them in doing their own development work, trying to build the capacities of people themselves to empower themselves and pull themselves out of poverty. So that's the model. So think about your lunch today and how it compares to what you usually eat. On my right is a lunch that probably is as good or maybe a little bit better than what we might normally have for lunch. Most of the rest of us, maybe we're on diets or health nuts, so we're not eating that much. But in general, most people of the world are eating a lot less and usually less good quality food than we normally do. And because we're surrounded by abundance, it's not part of our daily experience to think about poverty and hunger. And that's the point of this exercise, is to try to bring to you and for all of us to share an experience, because not all of us can go to developing countries and see it ourselves. So we have to bring the experience to ourselves and try to be mindful of it in our daily lives. Right now, no one knows how many people are hungry. There are economic and statistical models that try to make an estimate on how many people around the world get fewer calories than is recommended by nutritionists. The number of calories that you're estimated to get per day is about 2,000 calories a day. And And then there's also lots of nutritional elements that you're supposed to get in that. And the best estimates of the world right now is about 850 million people as of about 2 years ago. That's something a little less than 1/6 of humanity is not eating right, not getting enough food, not getting enough nutrition, not getting enough calories. And a large portion of those people that are suffering malnutrition are children. And of course, children need good nutrition most in order to have a full trajectory of their life, to have full brain capacity and the ability to help themselves throughout their lives. And if they fail to get good nutrition, especially in the very young ages, it's very clear that people don't perform at their highest capacity throughout their life. So it's a real crisis as an individual matter not to get enough food early on in your life. It's a trauma and difficult later in your life, but it's something you can recover from, but not for children. Over the last couple of years, we've seen food prices climb steadily and then spike in the last 18 months or so. Over the last 3 years, food prices have increased about 85% for most of the basic commodities that form the basis of food, things like wheat and corn and so forth. And again, no one really knows what's happening because it's all very new, but different estimates have come out about what that means. The U.S. Department of Agriculture thinks that has put about 130 million more people into hunger than had been before. So now the number is closer to a billion people who aren't getting enough food. And there's a simple arithmetic about income and price. And if you have a certain income, you can afford to buy a certain amount of food. If you produce food, then you can eat your own production. But if you don't produce food, then you have to buy it on the market. So as prices for food goes up, a large portion of humanity can buy less food or can buy no food at all. So people are losing access to food as prices go up. That said, hunger is not fundamentally an issue of scarcity. There's more than enough food. There's more than enough calories produced in the world to provide a healthy supply of food for every person. We live fundamentally by the numbers in a world of abundance. And the issue is more about how food is distributed and whether people can access that food given their situations. And the story of this lunch is that some people, despite abundance, don't access or can't access sufficient food because they don't have the income or because they're deprived of their rights or they're marginalized in different ways. And even rich countries have some cases of lack of access to food. In this country, not everybody at all times has access to sufficient food. And the numbers vary a bit, but some people estimate as many as 30 million people in this country every year don't have constant access to food. Doesn't mean they're always hungry, but at certain times of the month when the paychecks have run dry, they need to go to food banks or rely on charity. We're kind of doing an abbreviated version of the typical program here, but I'll just spend a little bit of time on what these groupings mean. The high-income grouping is about 15% of the world's population. And as Michael said, by high-income, we don't mean high income by US standards, but by global standards. And that's about an income of about $10,000 a year. These are averages and meant to be indicative, but that's, so on average, people in that group are it's like 15% of the world, and they're earning about $10,000 a year. And in general, they have access to healthcare, and in general, they have very good access to food, and education is usually supplied or accessible for their children. So that's the life we live mostly in this country and in Europe and Japan and Korea and the OECD countries. In the middle group is about 35% of the world. And incomes there range from about $1,500 a year to about $10,000 a year. And for many of these people, they are farmers and laborers, and they rely on some income, sometimes diversified strategies for how they earn cash. They usually have enough access for food, but it's easy to fall through the cracks. And one bad harvest or one health crisis can mean that they fall into destitution pretty easily. And in the low-income group is something like half the world's population, with about a billion to 1.5 billion people, so about a sixth to a fourth of the world falling into a very deep level of poverty that the UN defines as about $1 a day, and where you simply don't have access to sufficient food, and where you do have some income from selling farm products or from your own labor, you have to make very difficult choices about how to spend the limited amount of money you make, either on food or on buying medicines when you have health problems, or to pay for education for children. Because in many of the countries that low-income people live, education is not provided as a public good. It's something that has to be paid for by families. So the food you eat, you may make sacrifices in the amount or the quality of food you eat in order to pay for medicines or to send your children to school or to buy farm implements for the next season. So these are the very difficult choices. And if you had a light lunch, it was because you were thinking about something else you wanted to use with the money. People in this situation often don't have access to clean water. Especially the women have very burdensome situations in terms of household chores. They have to walk distances to get firewood and to get water. You can spend hours a day just walking to the nearest well to get to bring water to the household. And hunger is a constant presence in the family. If not, it's always looming in the background, if not present in their everyday life. There's very little health care, and what there is not usually provided as a public good. It's something you have to purchase, and it's often very poor quality because you're not really seeing doctors, but seeing sometimes neighborhood pharmacists who aren't very well trained. So, thinking about where we are in time right now, we are in a time of rising food prices and rising commodity prices. Now, the news today is about the economic crisis that we're facing, and mostly that's probably bad news for people around the world because economic growth is critically important to pull people out of poverty. But on the other hand, I think it's very likely that it will mean that commodity prices, energy and food commodities prices will decline as economic growth declines. So not to say it's good news, but the story that we've been seeing for the last 3 years where food supplies are becoming very tight and prices becoming very high may be moderated. But at the same time, we may see incomes being evaporated around the world. So somebody asked me, well, what does it all mean for poor people? And I think the answer is we don't really know. It's hard to see a silver lining, and yet the impacts of these policies and programs will flow out in unpredictable ways. What has caused the run-up in food prices in the last few years is a confluence of factors. One is the increasing demand for food. And many countries have been on a steady growth of consumption and income and are eating more food, sometimes more food, or eating higher protein foods which require more grain to produce, like beef or chicken. And so that demand has been growing, especially as countries like China and Mexico and others eat more and more proteins and fats. And that's a good thing in general because they're improving their nutrition and their overall health and their consumption. And it's good that people have choices. But it does create more demand, and if supply can't match the demand, then prices go up. There are other factors involved, including some constraints on supply, where food production has faced obstacles. There have been droughts and floods that have affected some countries in particular, or some global markets. The wheat markets in particular were impacted by a drought in Australia, which is a major wheat producer, for example. But in general, production has been pretty good in the last couple of years, and so production hasn't been the problem. But it's important to note that we face a future of potential problems in production with the advent of climate change. All the forecasts and models predict that there will be problems with agriculture production, especially in the poorest countries in the future. So even if production isn't problematic now, we're very worried about the future, where in some countries in Africa, the estimates say that agricultural productivity could decline by as much as 25%. So something to be very concerned about for the future, about the food supply, especially in the poorest countries. But back to demand and the increase in demand. There is a new phenomenon on global food markets, which is that large portions of the food supply are now being shifted into energy. And there's a convergence of energy and food markets in the form of biofuels. And this year, the United States will be converting about one-third of our corn harvest into ethanol. And since the United States is by far the biggest corn producer around the world, we produce about 40% of the world's corn. That has a pretty big impact. We're essentially taking one-tenth of the world's corn out of the food markets and putting it into energy markets and driving our cars with it. So this is driving prices for corn and other food commodities up. And I think it's something that you wouldn't have noticed if you hadn't seen a lot of newspaper articles about it. Maybe you haven't noticed it at all. And the point is that something that's kind of small to us, what's the mixture of ethanol and gasoline in the fuel supply? You probably don't pay attention to that when you fill up your tank. And yet it's having very big impacts on markets and having very big impacts on poor people and whether they can access the food they need. And so the point I want to make there is that our policies, so things that we do in this country, are hardly noticeable to us and yet cascade down to have very big impacts on poor people. And we really need to pay a lot more attention to the effects that small things we do here have on poor people, because even small things we do here can have very big impacts. Thinking about food, the average American household spends about 10% of our income on food. And so if food prices increase 50%, which is way more than they have increased for Americans, you're still talking about an increase in your costs for food, about 5% of your income. I'm just making rough estimates. But in many of the poorest countries, like our middle group here, people are spending 50 to 80% of their income on food. And so a 50% increase in food prices has a much bigger impact on their livelihoods and their household economies than it would here. So small changes here. This year we had about a 4 to 5% food inflation rate in this country. Have very big impact, small impacts for households here, but very big impacts for households in developing countries. I don't want to go on too long, and I want to make sure we have time to have a discussion. But Michael asked me to talk about the role of trade and policy and investments in this, and to mention that there are very very significant implications for food security and hunger in trade and international governance. And as food prices have gone up in the last couple of years, we've seen many countries take very aggressive action to try to respond. But some of that action has actually created problems for other countries. Basically exported the food price increases to other countries. Some countries like India and Thailand and Ukraine, when food prices started going up, put export restrictions on their exports in order to maintain lower food prices in those countries. But that restricted the supply for importing countries and raised prices for them. So you saw real crises emerge in some countries where they couldn't import the food that they need. And this tells us a couple stories. One is the importance of the interrelationship between countries and food supply, and that we shouldn't be cavalier about restricting our exports. And on the other hand, that there are risks to being dependent on one another, and that the philosophy in the past has been that we should become more and more dependent on one another. But for the poorest people in the poorest countries, there are some risks involved as prices go up and as supplies go down and exports go down. And in particular, as rich countries are diverting larger supplies of their food supplies, larger portions of their food supplies into energy rather than food. And that's an argument for some measure of self-dependence and reliance by poor people and poor countries. Rather than relying on global markets or imports for their food supplies, they really need to focus on re-energizing their own production and their own self-reliance in order to make sure that they have some diversity of supply and some ability to cope when there are shocks to the system. The head of the UN agency on agriculture has said that the food crisis that we've been facing in recent months is not a story like a Greek tragedy in which humans are the toys of the gods and will meet their fates decided by the rules of the gods. The food crisis is a product of human policies and human actions, and can be resolved by human actions and policies. And so hunger is fundamentally a social and human phenomenon. It's not, as I said, except in some cases, an issue of scarcity. There are droughts where food supplies are evaporated, but on the whole, the majority of hungry people lack access because of their poverty rather than because of a scarcity of food. And so this is something to learn about and to think about for ourselves, that there are things we can do, not only just in the form of charity and giving assistance, but in terms of the changing the way our governments operate, how our governments interrelate, how trade operates, and how power is allocated, that have a big impact on poverty and on food security. So I think I'll stop there and invite my colleagues to come make some comments, and then maybe we can have a discussion.
Well, I think Caroline has covered the ground pretty well. Since he's covered the ground so well, I'll put in some caveats, which I think it's important to do, which I might not have started off with. First, I think we need to distinguish between hunger and malnutrition, which are two totally different things, although they tend to be presented as though they are one. To give you an example, in India, the estimate is there are maybe 420, 450 million people suffering from malnutrition of any kind. But there's a survey which asks people, were you hungry, A, any month of the year, and B, right through the year? And those two categories put together come to only 45 million people. So, you know, there's a huge gap, apparently, between perceived hunger, people saying they're hungry, and what nutritionists call malnutrition. There is this malnutritional norm of, in India, 2,200 calories was thought to be an appropriate average for the country as a whole. It's pretty well an international thing, but I had to write a column when I first came here and went into a Subway sandwich shop, because if you go there, you'll find on their napkins, they're advertising themselves, and they say, you know, a ham and turkey sandwich here is only 280 calories, whereas a Big Mac is 450, and a Whopper at Burger King is 550. So Subway was merely boasting about how low calorie it was. What struck me was something completely different. I said, what you're saying is, if I have a Subway sandwich for breakfast, a Big Mac for lunch, and a Whopper for dinner, the total is only 1450 calories, so I'm suffering from severe malnutrition, according to the nutritionist. And you know, I really scratched my head. I wrote about this. I had an exchange with nutritionists in India who had no obvious answer to me. So I asked myself, is there some kind of attempt on the part of nutritionists and others to exaggerate what the human beings are really required? Because that would also perhaps provide a partial answer to this huge gap we have in India between people who claim that they are hungry and any measures of poverty or any other measures in nutrition. So I'm just putting that as a caveat. I said, if in India I say the number of hungry people is not 450 million, it's only 45. Well, you know, 45 is still a very huge number. It's not something to be wished away. It's just that we need to get the dimensions right. Malnutrition includes things like anemia. We had a health survey in India. Among the top 20% of income households, anemia is 60%. So, you know, there are all kinds of crinkles with the quality of food that we are getting. But yes, there is substantial hunger. I think we also need to say that how is it people have coped with hunger? You know, remember there was no Oxfam, there was no international trade, there was no food aid through most of history. And yet people coped with all kinds of drugs. They coped by moving out. I mean, rice, I see that this rice here is being distributed as what people eat in poor countries. I think I need to point out, this is the most expensive of all cereals, the most expensive. In India, as poor people rise up the income ladder, they will progress from coarse grain to rice as saying, I'm now richer, I'm superior. So, you know, the difference may not strike you, but people trade up between different kinds of grains,
whether or not you have beads, whether or not you can have a few fats through dairy products. So all this is happening. I mean, let me stop right there, because I wish to return to the point that yes, there is widespread hunger, but I just worry about the figures I see of real hunger. Malnutrition is a more complex problem. Gawain didn't touch on the long-term issues. If you look at the last 30, 40 years, one of the problems that there has been that because of massive subsidies in rich countries, there has tended to be overproduction of agricultural commodities, which are then dumped abroad at low prices. And this has been a problem for farmers in third world countries all over the place. So the current round of the World Trade Organization is attempting to make some changes out here, reduce those subsidies. It's not got very, very far. The Doha round is deadlocked right now. And yet I believe something will come of it after a few years. But it's worth pointing out that while right now the price of wheat, maize, corn, all these things have doubled or tripled in a very short period, a more long-term problem has not been that prices are too high, but prices have been too low. The higher prices that you're seeing are a considerable benefit for a very large number of farmers in third world countries. I think that also needs to be kept in account. So high food prices are not unambiguously bad for poor countries. It's ambiguous. The farmers benefit, the landless laborer who doesn't grow anything, he is at a disadvantage. But it's not a uniform thing across the board for all poor countries, and most people, poor countries in rural areas, have some land and do some farming. It's only a very small minority that have no land and depend entirely on labor. So it's ambiguous. Having said that, I hope that in the long run, food prices end up higher than they historically have been after we have the WTO deal. We don't want a huge spike of doubling and tripling within 18 months as we have right now. But we do need prices at a higher level than they've been historically to encourage farmers. Okay, those are the two broad things. Now let's get down to the production spikes, two of the key issues that Gawain mentioned. The huge rise in food prices right now is due much more to the action of third world countries who have put trade barriers. Well, it's not just third world countries, but countries of various kinds, mainly third world countries, that have put these trade barriers. According to the FAO data which I went through, the world has had two record grain harvests in a row in 2007-2008. Despite two record harvests, prices have gone through the roof in the world market. Why? Then you look at the data and you find, despite record harvests, the amount of rice to be traded and wheat to be traded is actually going to fall. Look at that. So there was production was not the problem, but a very large number of countries decided to put these trade curbs. Now, in the case of India, we banned the export of wheat in 2007 itself. Then there was a very, very high ceiling put on the export price of rice, so that only a very specialty rice, basmati rice, could be exported and nothing else. And this year they banned the export of maize as well. From the Indian point of view, this has been a brilliant form of inflation control. The price of food grains in India is up only 6 or 7%, which is less than the average rate of inflation. But neighboring Bangladesh, which was importing rice from us, the price of rice is up 50%. So this has been called a beggar your neighbor policy or a starve your neighbor policy. So you can't get away from the fact that in a country divided into nation states, every nation which has some grain, which was an exporter, is going to protect itself. And yet, how do we get to a situation where there can be some safeguards for those limited number of countries that were dependent on imports and find that the price of rice has in some cases gone 300% of what it used to be? I have racked my brains on this particular thing. A suggestion has been made that within the World Trade Organization, can we have some kind of agreement preventing countries from putting an export curb? It would be extremely difficult, I think, to implement this. Given the strength of national feeling, it would be very difficult. It would be even more difficult because many of these curbs would be applied on developing countries, which for whom they say, food price is a matter of life and death. You can't take this away from them. And so what can we do? I mean, I have a few ideas. For instance, there can be an international agreement of a certain minimum export of an exporting country. That if a country is an exporter, the next year, even if it's in trouble, it should agree to export at least 10% of what it did in the previous year. Just a cushion measure. There's an alternative one to get over the political economy, I think, of the problem. Right now in India, the politicians say we must stop the export of all grain in order to reduce domestic inflation, because that's a very large voting constituency. If you said, okay, let there be a special quota of 1 million tons, which we will buy only from small and marginal farmers and export, then maybe there'll be a political constituency among small and marginal farmers, who may then be willing to say, okay, some political rewards for this. So even if overall prices go up a little, if you can get so many farmers happy, because the farmers that would be exporting would be exporting at 2.5 times the domestic price. The world price is 2.5 times. So if you can offer this bait, maybe it's possible to once again say there can be a minimum export quota in some of these surplus countries. I think you might have an agreement, for instance, in WTO to say that if a country is going to impose an export curb, let it give at least 2 months' notice. I mean, if you had done that, I think some of the panic that we saw earlier this year might have been avoided. And prices suddenly spiked. I mean, they came down a little later. Similarly, I think if every country gives advance notice of when it's going to resume exports, that again would cool markets. So, I mean, there are a certain number of limited suggestions that I have. Over and above that, there has been some suggestion that when prices are very low, it might be a good idea to build up a buffer stock, which is available later on. I mean, I have seen my 45-odd years as a journalist. Every decade, suddenly, you know, first there'll be a huge spike in prices, then everybody grows so much, the prices crash again. And then the next decade, once again, there'll be a shortage, a huge spike in prices. So the cyclicality of prices is so much that maybe you could have a buffer stock to meet the needs of some of the countries most in need. This would need financing by the rich countries. This is one of the possible solutions I think there could be. Second issue again, which Gawain referred to, biofuels. And it goes beyond biofuels, I would say, to other forms of renewable energy too. In the case of ethanol, the United States this year, I think, is going to divert 102 million tons of corn to ethanol. I mean, just think how many people that could feed. A very, very huge number. Now, obviously, American farmers are not in the business of feeding hungry people. They are in the business of growing corn and selling to earn income for their own families. Nothing wrong with that. But the boom that has happened right now has not happened because people need more maize. It is a government-mandated rule. If there had not been this rule mandating the use of ethanol in various states and by the third place, you would not have got a situation where such a huge amount was artificially diverted. I mean, it wasn't in response to what you might call normal market demand for ethanol. It was specifically a way of helping agro-industry and saying that, you know, this will help us towards energy independence. Even though everybody knows that the contribution of it to energy is infinitesimal, tiny. I mean, 6% was one estimate I came across. But yet it's had this huge effect on diverting 1/3 of all the corn to ethanol. It is the boom in maize production to meet the ethanol has meant that farmers have grown less wheat, has grown less soybean. So this has other implications for other crops as well. In America, the mandate is on gasoline. In Europe, there's a mandate on diesel, that a certain percentage of diesel there should be met by renewable means. And so more and more vegetable oils are being diverted, not only from Europe but the world over, to mix with diesel in Europe. They want 1/10 of their diesel, ultimately, to be what they call renewable sources. So you have a situation where the price of rapeseed oil, soybean oil, palm oil, all these things are shooting up. They're all shooting up because somebody in Germany, somebody in Europe has decided that, you know, what a good thing, that as a green thing, we should now have renewable energy. Now, as Gawain said, you know, some very small things in a rich country can have disastrous impact in a poor country. So when what looks like a very modest amount of vegetable oil is being mixed with diesel, if this sends prices skyrocketing, it has implications in third world countries. Even in terms just of the emissions issue, if you cut down a tropical jungle to grow more soybean, you find that on balance, you think you're being green, you think you're switching from a fossil fuel to a renewable source, but because you're losing that much of the forest, even in terms of carbon emissions, you're actually worse off. So all these things need to be handled very carefully on what we do about biofuels. To the extent that biofuels reduce global warming, you certainly can justify a subsidy as a cost of reducing pollution. The question is, can't we do it in various ways which don't make it compete with food? For instance, in the United States, if you want to mix ethanol, you should say ethanol should be available from any source. The cheapest source of ethanol would be to import it from Brazil, because Brazil very efficiently makes ethanol very directly from sugarcane. America very inefficiently makes ethanol from corn, and on balance there may be no energy gain at all, although the experts debate that particular issue. But there's a huge tariff that the US places on imports of ethanol. So it's just a way of protecting a highly inefficient and iniquitous conversion of corn into ethanol, when a much more sensible solution would be to get it directly from Brazil. So I said, there are good and bad ways of promoting this. Similarly, I think if you say that for diesel, depending on the source, there's a plant called Jatropha, which is grown on all kinds of marginal areas, and it yields an oil which can be mixed with diesel, like biodiesel. So I mean, if the Europeans provide a subsidy for that kind of product, it should be much higher than the subsidy just for saying any vegetable oil. That kind of thing, again, would make a distinction between what is competing with and what is not competing with food production. I need to add that the new thing about solar energy, people are getting very excited about some new solar energy projects in the Mojave Desert in the USA. Now there are these new parabolic shaped troughs, parabolic mirrors, and there's this long tube of water in the middle, and the sun's rays come, they get concentrated on that particular thing, and it turns into steam, and then you can generate conventional power from it. And half a dozen really big projects are coming up here, and there's talk of trying to replicate this in India and various other countries. I went and looked at the data, and land required. If you want to generate 1,000 megawatts of power in the Mojave Desert, they're taking up to 10,000 acres. If you begin to divert that kind of land, again, you'd have to think. There's some people who say, well, maybe there's enough desert land. I don't know. This may not be true of all places in all countries. Certainly, even in what's called desert in India, there are grazing lands. There are places with minor timber, minor collection of various kinds of produce. So you need to be quite careful about mandating various things which may have these unexpected effects. Finally, I think, you know, you need to have countries who grow more food in some of the very vulnerable countries. India in 1965 and 66 suffered from two major droughts, as a result of which India became a country which was importing, I think, 80% of the entire food aid and food transfers of the world were going to India. There were two American experts, Paddock and Paddock, who wrote a book saying India is a country incapable of feeding itself. We must not waste the world's precious food on India. India has to be allowed to starve so that food can be diverted to the countries that are capable of being viable. You know, I hear some kind of remarks like this about some African countries from time to time. But what happened in India can be done everywhere else with appropriate research, with appropriate new varieties, with appropriate investment in irrigation and marketing. All the countries which seem to be in bad shape, they too can have their green revolution. So, you know, although it's one thing to say, what do rich countries do? In some sense, it's the poor countries that have to get their act together. The Green Revolution needs to come to Africa. Africa fundamentally still has a very low population density indeed compared to Asia. It has substantial water and land resources which can be harnessed. I mean, many African countries, if you ask me, especially Sudan, are capable of being massive exporters of food. I mean, you just look at the agroclimatic conditions. So a lot of work needs to be done there. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much. I understand some people might have to leave, but we are going to continue for another half hour, have some reflections, and ask some questions. I'll allow you to respond to any comments that were made. But first of all, I have a question of my own, which wasn't talked and that was talked about, which is about genetically modified foods and how you think that's going to be influenced by the food crisis. And obviously, there are a lot of pushes in India, especially with the U.S. trying to have a side deal with the nuclear agreement to have the intellectual property of Monsanto's biologically engineered food to be respected. And this creates a lot of problems. I know there have been a lot of suicides with Indian farmers, and they're not really, a lot of people think it's because they're not used to the single generation seeds that they've created. And I'm just curious to hear any insights about that you might have. And then we're opening up the floor, so if anyone has questions, please, this is supposed to be interactive. So.
Okay, on the genetically modified side, the story is actually much more positive. There has been resistance from various green groups to genetically modified food, which I regard as the most unscientific rubbish I've ever come across, and I've tried to rubbish it where I have come. I said this, right through history, how have different species, how did we evolve from fish? How did we evolve from, it all took place as a result of huge genetic modifications. In nature, there has always been all kinds of mutations which have changed things. And the idea that if a human being does it, it's a monster. I just don't see what's happening out there, even if it is across a genome. There is all this talk about, how do you prove that a genetically modified food is safe? Well, I know for a fact that all natural food is unsafe. I know that if I take sugars, all kinds of people are being killed by diabetes. I know if I take ordinary fats and dairy products, all kinds of people are dying of heart. I mean, it's beyond proof that all natural foods are dangerous. So think about, how do you prove genetically modified foods are safe? I mean, what does that word mean? The natural foods are unsafe. I merely say that we need, therefore, to say, you have whatever tests you want. Test it for 2-3 years. I mean, something's, just in case there's some huge toxicity in some particular thing. After that, you need to go ahead and you get away from the idea that anything is a monster. Because if so, all human beings are monsters, because the human race has evolved through a series of astonishing mutations. In India itself, there was huge resistance. The first thing being introduced on the genetically modified side was cotton, BT cotton. And you had a large number of greens saying this should never be allowed, it would be a tragedy. It was not allowed, and they sat around trying various tests and agonizing over it. While they were agonizing over it, completely illegally, various Indian companies were clever enough, they began to do reverse engineering and produce genetically modified cotton themselves, in effect copying Monsanto's technology without giving them any royalties. Soon this thing began to spread like wildfire. All the greens wrote, do you know how terrible this is? The farmers found it was so successful, they grew more and more. Then the greens wrote a series of articles claiming that the yields are very low and this is bad. The actual production turned out to be higher than ever. I mean, I really lost respect for the greens on this issue. They just told a series of lies. Now, there may be real issues with genetically modified issues. The way it happened in India, we are getting to the stage today, I think the production of cotton basically has doubled from about 15 million bales to 30 million bales, and about 80% of farmers are going to switch over to genetically modified cotton. So just to give you an idea of a huge success, this was not a genetically modified food, right? It was not a food item, it was a fiber. I see no reason why we should adopt a different position in regard to that. In fact, what's happened is that in Europe, because they have a particular resistance to genetically modified food, when there was an attempt to introduce genetically modified maize in Africa, they more or less warned, they said, if you plant even a little amount, who knows, through the breeze, this thing can spread to some other thing. And if it contaminates your crops, Europe will not import any crops or any agricultural products at all from Africa. I mean, this sent the fear of God into African countries. So I'm saying, don't do this, because somebody, big white chief in Europe, is going to levy a huge penalty on you potentially. And so governments got very worried about this kind of thing. Now, to me, this, it's one thing. The Europeans say that for cultural reasons, they don't want to eat something. It's their problem. But when it has these international effects, I really do worry.
The issue of genetically modified food is a highly politicized one, with people on all sides of the issue making claims that are really not very well substantiated. And I think some of the resistance to it is ideologically, or you might even argue sort of spiritually based about God's creation and whether humans should be meddling in this sort of form. And I think it's also important to say that there are risks. There are risks in any new technology. And you don't know what the implications of unleashing new technologies are until you test it. And so I think it's not inappropriate to be cautious in adopting and thinking about new technologies. I remember reading about when they did the first nuclear test in New Mexico. The scientists involved prayed beforehand. They honestly didn't know what would happen when a nuclear explosion happened. There was a small chance, they thought, that the fires would explode into the atmosphere and humanity would be ended. And it didn't seem like likely, but it was a possibility. And you have to say that we don't always know what the implications are from these technologies. So I think it's not unreasonable to be cautious and somewhat worried about what these new technologies would do. There is a phenomenon of pollution in which genetically modified genes spread out from the plants that you're using into wild plants or into non-genetically modified plants. So there are risks involved about the genes and the gene traits spreading out. So all of this is to argue that there is a very strong and clear need for caution, testing, observation in using these technologies. On the other hand, it's evidently clear that farmers like them and that farmers use them, and some farmers benefit quite a lot from them. In the U.S., there's very wide penetration into the market for corn and cotton and some other commodities for use of genetically modified seeds. My colleague talked about the sort of voluntary usage in India. That's also true in many other countries, including Brazil, which had a ban on genetically modified soybeans, but the farmers went over the border and smuggled them back because they wanted to use them because their production was better. But this raises another issue, which is that these technologies, you can think of genetically modified organisms as being something like vaccines or medicines, where if they're not used carefully, they start losing their value. A lot of the technologies are oriented towards pest control, for example. But if you don't use it carefully, the pests will also mutate and evolve, and then the value of the GM, the genetically modified trait, is evaporated. So they need to be carefully used so that you don't, while you're using genetically modified cotton, which is meant to reduce the loss of cotton to pests, then breed a new, higher, more effective form of pest. So you need to use the technology carefully and have a strong regulatory and management process. And the problem, I think, is that the advertisements for these technologies have been overstated about what they're going to do. They're going to feed the world. They're going to save farmers. And it's true that there are benefits, but they need to be embedded in regulation and proper management. And many countries aren't yet at that stage. And need support to do that. And Oxfam is right now doing a multi-country study of the introduction of genetically modified technologies to see what the impact has been on smallholder farmers in using them. And we do generally find that they've been positive, but also that it's much more complicated than you would expect. And just giving a farmer a seed doesn't assure them a better product, and that they need a lot more training, regulation, support, management, in order to make this technology really benefit them. It's just like any technology, if it's the thing itself is only part of it, and it's the management and use of it that can be the much bigger part of getting a benefit out of it. So in short, I think that there will be interest in using new technologies, and genetically modified technologies are one of them. In a lot of places, other much more simpler technologies are useful, things like small engine tractors and basic irrigation can be at least as important as using genetically modified seeds, but it should be within the tool chest of options for developing countries to use. So this is probably a kind of nuanced response, but to say that we don't want to be categorical about it, but to be cautious about it, just like we would with any technology.
Nice food left in this table. Someone really wants, we don't want to get it wasted. We have been talking about, or you've been talking about the balance between some environmental issues like renewable fuels versus fossil fuels and their impact on the global food model. And I had two questions about it. One is it's about the fuels. Of course, the food prices also depend on fuel prices, and rising fuel prices driving food prices because of transportation issues and so on and so on. So how do you reach a balance between food prices actually going up due to the lack of fossil fuels, and again food prices going up because of the usage of food corn in the United States for the fuel? And secondly, on the environmental issue, for instance, in Indonesia, much of the rainforest in Borneo is being cut down. The area being used to grow palm seed oil, which is increasingly being used in food, food and other consumer goods. So how do you strike a balance between environmental protections? The argument the Indonesian government is using as well, we need to use this highly fertile area to grow food and drive food prices down in our country and in the area. At the same time, for instance, the rainforest being destroyed and species are being eradicated there because of their environment being cut down. So how do you strike a balance between those two issues? And does any of those issues prevail in certain situations?
The question of food versus energy and the energy prices growing up has a push factor, a cost factor in terms of food production, because energy is an input into food. So you use energy to produce food, at least in this country. In this country, food production is highly energy intensive. We use a lot of diesel oil and gasoline to produce our food, in tractors and transportation and drying commodities. But there's also a pull factor. When prices go up for gasoline, it makes ethanol as a substitute more efficient. So if energy prices go down, you'll see food prices go down, and if energy prices go up, you see food prices go up, both because of these push factors and because of the pull factors, pulling more food into the energy market because prices are up. What's the balance? Well, one issue is that a lot of this has been driven by policy, by government policies pushing food into fuel. And that's an issue that really urgently needs to be addressed. We've been driving this market through government policies. In the future, I think, with or without government policies, we've reached a stage where the conversion of food into fuel will happen on its own because of high prices. There's a break point somewhere around $100, $110 a barrel where it becomes cost effective to convert corn into ethanol. And so this is the reality. But as my colleague mentioned, it's not all bad. The truth is that most poor people are involved in farming in some way. And so if prices go up for farm products, that offers opportunities to farmers. The issue that we've seen in the last 2 years has been the volatility and the extremely rapid rise where farmers haven't been able to respond to take advantage of them, and the creating dislocations and economic crises in some cases, rather than being an opportunity that that can have a response and be orderly. So to the extent that that's been driven by government policies, we need to take a step back. But to the extent that it offers opportunities, we also need to maximize that. So all of this gets to a really important need to really focus more attention on poor countries being able to produce more, both food but also energy in the form of agricultural products, and to take advantage of these higher prices and also to become less dependent on the volatile international markets. So that's one thing. And then you had a second question or related. What was that one? Oh,
the rainforest.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that. In the case of Indonesia, a lot of the market seems to be driven by increased demand for biodiesel, which is mostly the Europeans. We use diesel in their cars. Europeans have set up a 10% target for using biodiesel in their fuel supply, and that's been driving dramatic increases in production or investment in production of biodiesel in the form of palm oil, especially. So if the European, just last week, the Europeans began to lower that target, and that may sort of soften the impact of these investments driving up. But palm oil prices have skyrocketed, and palm diesel prices have skyrocketed because of this existing and projected demand. And so, again, policy plays a pretty big role in it. Whether converting rainforest into agricultural production is necessary for food supply, I think is a very debatable point. There are a lot of ways to increase food supply without cutting down forests. For example, increasing the productivity of existing production. A lot of developing countries are very unproductive. African countries are produce per acre about 20% what American farmers produce. So there's a very high steep curve where production can go up without converting any more land into agricultural land. So I think that, of course, would be a better focus, probably much more environmentally sustainable. And that is probably an area where policy can make a difference to try to channel investments in that direction rather than extending the amount of land that's being used, intensifying the uses of existing land. So that's one observation on that point.
I'd simply add that, you know, under the Kyoto Protocol, nobody is given any brownie points for preserving existing forest. You've given it if you cut down the forest, then you get something for growing the forest again, but not for preserving the forest. So one way of attaining a better balance may be to expand the kind of things for which you get credits under the Kyoto Protocol. Beyond that, as I said, you know, earlier on, there are sensible and non-sensible ways of attempting to determine how much of land is diverted. This business of energy independence, which I've heard of every president from Nixon onwards, and it's complete rubbish. You know, it is not even rational for anybody to have energy independence. Why should you? Even today, you know, it's gas at $4 a gallon. You know, would you like to look around at what's the price of Coca-Cola is? Probably more than that. Or, you know, it is not expensive even at $4 a barrel. I mean, you've been spoiled rotten for some time, maybe. But the plain fact is there's nothing expensive. You know what the cost of diesel is, of edible oils in India? I mean, it's much, much higher than that. So the only reason why you can mix it along with diesel is if the government is forcing you through a mandate or there's some special subsidy being given. So the truth is that, as far as I am concerned, the price of fossil fuels is not high in any absolute sense whatsoever. And rather than governments attempt to say somehow force people, so, you know, no, we have to, in the name of independence, more and more agricultural land must be diverted. This is just bad policy.
We have another question. Hi. I recently returned from living in Madagascar, which is an extremely poor country, and experienced the food crisis firsthand. And I watched from the first year I was there when rice prices were very low, and through the second year when they were extremely high. And Madagascar is a country that doesn't have much export, but they import a lot of their rice. And recently the president has implemented a big family planning initiative to combat hunger and malnutrition. And I was wondering if you, either of you could speak to initiatives that developing countries are implementing that are kind of outside the box, and in terms of education development or health development, and hopefully that's not too outside the scope of what we're talking about.
Well, you know, economic development is supposed to raise incomes and the productivity of individuals. And if you do that and if it applies to agriculture, you'll get it. I don't know enough about Madagascar. Why a country should be importing rice instead of growing... If they don't grow enough rice, why are they not growing something else? I don't know the answer to that. But by and large, through history, there was very little trade in grain. By and large, villages were self-sufficient, right? So the trade is a relatively recent thing. So I don't really know that. But if you are going to develop any society, you need to bring in agricultural development, education, roads, the works. And if you do that efficiently, every country becomes rich very fast. And it will do well in agriculture as well. As I said, India was written off as a lost case in 65 and came back with a bang. And I like to quote that, that India was supposed to be unviable and only worthy of being left to starve. This was the expert verdict of two eminent American scholars at the time. So I mean, if we could overcome that, any country can.
This population growth, though, I mean, that's got to be... Developing countries are their populations are growing exponentially. That's got to be an issue.
It's not an issue. That's exactly what they said about India. That's exactly why they said India must be left to starve. Exactly those arguments were wrong. You said they were all wrong. The truth is that if you have half-decent policies, incomes will rise so fast that you will have a labor shortage.
Yeah, the experience has been that, well, I mean, it's a very complicated equation, but that rising incomes have led to reproductive, more reproductive control. And there's an issue of empowerment. I mean, in general, families, and especially women, would like to control their fertility more than they are. And for social reasons and for basic access to reproductive technologies, they're not able to. So as a basic human rights issue, I think women and families ought to have access and the ability to control the reproduction. But as an economic factor, it's not at all clear that that's an important thing. In fact, many people argue that population growth is important and valuable to generating economic growth, and that in fact Africa's probably underpopulated to generate the kind of critical mass. And looking at the experiences of the East Asian countries that have really grown very fast, population density was an important factor. And so creating density or maybe overall numbers may actually help reduce poverty and in time reduce reproductivity among the among families. So it's, all this to say, it's a lot more complicated than thinking it as one thing or another. I guess some guidance we have about it is that it does seem like investing in agriculture has the highest payoff in terms of reducing poverty, and we as donors and as governments, we've been neglecting agriculture for several decades. We used to contribute about 30% of our aid in the form of agricultural support for developing countries, and these days it's around 6% of our aid. And aid has been growing, so it's about the same amount of money, but it's a much smaller factor in our aid. And we so the general feeling now is that we really need to rebalance in favor of agriculture and supporting developing country farmers to be more productive. Another factor is that it's not just seeds, it's not technology that has driven it. The growth in China was very rapid, and poverty has been reduced. And it did start in agriculture, and it had nothing to do with technology. It had to do with governance and policies, basically empowering small Chinese farmers to produce more and to benefit from it because of the collectivization. They had no incentive to do it, and giving them the incentive to be more productive unleashed growth and poverty reduction. So thinking a lot about policy as a generator of growth rather than technologies or institutions, those can be important, but there's a lot of bad policy out there, and that can really unleash the power of markets to help poor people and to help poor people be more engaged in markets.
I think that's amazing. Thank you so much. I think we're running out of time. I have one last question, and I hate to throw a big one at you at the end, but a lot of people have complained about the investment chapter in NAFTA, for instance, and how it has affected Mexican farmers. I'm just curious how you think the liberalization of investment internationally, especially related to agriculture, is likely to progress, and if you have any specific viewpoints on it you'd like to talk about. I know it's a big issue, but obviously with public funding down so much for investment in agriculture, and there's some people now are talking about China investing in Sudan. You were talking about Sudan earlier. So that's private investment, even though it's through the country, so I guess it's a little different. Just how do you see things playing out? Do you think there's a public role here, or do you think that most of this will get taken care of through private funds? And how should this all be set up legally, in your opinion?
In my view, as a journalist who has seen it all, this phase will pass very soon. At the end of it all, nationalist objections to foreigners coming over and buying enormous tracts of land is huge. even in Africa. And in any case, in some of the places with large open lands, when you consider the incidence of civil war, disease, various other issues, it's very easy to talk of going into Sudan. And then the question is, you know, you will have to go with bodyguards all over the place and wonder who's going to descend on you next. So it will not be easy. So I said, in theory, it is possible to have these very, very large areas brought under. In practice, I think there would be politically huge resistance within those countries for any significant amount of land to be given away. While we are talking about it, I don't think it's going to work. The only possible exception might be some huge areas in places like Kazakhstan and so on, where truly they may say, you know, there is no real feeling about this land. It's not a densely, you know, it isn't that there are villages all over the place. It isn't that Kazakh farmers are short of land. There are truly these huge areas with very small population. Maybe in a few countries, very few countries like that, it may be possible. By and large, I don't think it will fly.
I think the story of NAFTA is interesting. There, you brought up some issues, and I think there are kind of two dimensions to it. One is the issue of the investment chapter of the free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada, which is there are similar investment chapters in other free trade agreements that the U.S. has negotiated with other countries. The concern that civil society groups and others have raised is that it sets up basically a super judicial process for disputes between investors and the government, in that way creates what some view, and we tend to agree, special rights for foreign investors in other countries. So if a U.S. investor has an investment in Mexico and has a problem because regulations change or something happened, they can take the case out of Mexican courts, not in U.S. courts, but to a special supranational adjudicating bodies with very little accountability. And so this is the concern: is creating these special rights and mechanisms for foreign investors that domestic investors don't enjoy. And in practice, there have been some cases that have been problematic, but it's been more of an abstract concern than a real concern thus far. And we still need to see how it plays out, but it remains a big issue and a concern among observers of free trade agreements about whether this is a good idea or not. At the multilateral level, at the WTO, the idea of creating those kinds of mechanisms for investors has fallen off the agenda. There's just no consensus to create that kind of thing multilaterally. So the only place it happens now is in bilateral agreements between the United States and other countries, and there are weaker ones but similar ones with European free trade agreements. So that's a concern on investment. Now, the reason to do that, the argument is that you want to create a more stable and reliable investment climate to encourage investment in countries. And the evidence on that is very poor. There is very little evidence that creating these kinds of mechanisms actually induces investors to go in more than they would otherwise. And there are some studies, I think, out of Tufts that have shown that the countries that actually have what are considered very bad investment law actually have been the countries that have received the most investment. And investors are generally making their decision making on other factors than these. They're investing in China because it's got a huge market and infrastructure. They're investing in Mexico because they can get access to the U.S. market through it. So the investment decisions, this is so marginal to investment decisions that it's not really inducing much investment and yet creating potential risks and liabilities for host countries in the process. So this is a discussion about investment chapters. I can tell you lots more. The other story is about Mexican agriculture and what happened under NAFTA. And it's a little bit more nuanced than what I'm about to say, but the basic theme is true, which is that through the 90s and into the early part of this century, the U.S. had massive surpluses in corn, and we were looking for ways to get rid of it. And eventually we decided we would make it into ethanol and burn it in our cars. That's what we're doing now. But for a long time, we were trying to think about what to do with it, and we were looking for markets for it. And when the free trade agreement with Mexico came through, we dumped a lot of corn on Mexican markets. Now, Mexico is the birthplace of corn. It's where the germ initially came from, and there are millions of Mexican corn farmers, most of them very small. And with U.S. corn flooding their market, corn prices collapsed. Tortilla prices, ironically, went up, and about a million Mexican corn farmers basically lost their livelihood and have either found other ways to live on the land or moved to the cities or increasingly are trying to come north. So it created a lot of economic dislocation. And so that's one of the very negative impacts of NAFTA. And you can see it repeated in different ways in other free trade agreements. Very bad examples in Dominican Republic and Haiti, for example, of our rice exports, for example. So that's the tension there. But my last comment is that despite all this, investments in developing countries are very important, especially in the agriculture sector. And so we're pretty supportive of that. There are some issues about going into corrupt governments and negotiating things where the farmers themselves or communities aren't getting say. There's lots of shady deals going on throughout the world, in Indonesia and in Tanzania and in Kenya, where foreign investors are coming in, buying access to land, sometimes not with questionable legal instruments, and local communities are very worried about what's going to happen to the land and to their communities because these investors are coming in, putting in plantations, and leaving the local communities out. That's the wrong kind of investment, we think. The right kind is to help communities produce more and then buy their production. And so thinking about this investment, and there's probably good and bad kinds of investment. It's not clear how you regulate it or whether you should, but there are models to probably be followed that are going to be more pro-poor and more sustainable over time.
Thank you so much. That was great. Just give a round of applause. Just a quick announcement. I'm actually the president of the International Trade and Investment Law Society. We're having a party tomorrow night. If you need directions, you can go to our blog, internationaltradeandinvestmentlaw.blogspot.com. Or you can come see me and I'll give you a card. Other than that, the Sustainable Development Law and Policy publication, their issue this fall is on the food crisis. So you're welcome to submit a feature, or if you know someone who would be willing to write an article, where they're accepting stories and applications, so come see them. Great.
Thank you. I'm glad to see the migration of poor people into the rich.